This evening I'm giving my talk to a mostly empty hall, and it's a very strange experience to give such a talk when there's no one here, because in my life as a Buddhist monk I'm usually used to giving talks in front of much larger crowds. And I think my record is about 10,000 people, which is quite a decent crowd in a huge hall, and some sitting outside as well. But it doesn't really matter, because part of the training which I received as a Buddhist monk is learning how to adapt to all different situations and to have that confidence and trust just in your training that whatever occurs for you, you could always not just bear it and endure it and wait for it to pass, but you can always get something out of it. There's always something which you can learn from whatever happens to you in life. And one of my favorite stories which has popped into my mind just now was the story, which I don't think I've told for quite a few years now, was the story of the story of the donkey who was walking through the forest. And as he was walking through the forest, the donkey fell into a big hole in the forest. It was a well, but the well was dry, it had been abandoned. And so the donkey was at the bottom of the well. The donkey wasn't injured at all, just a bit bruised and a bit of concerned, but he was at the bottom of the well and couldn't get himself out. He was in trouble. And so the donkey started to yell, "Eeyaw! Eeyaw! Eeyaw!" trying to get someone's attention so he could be saved from being at the bottom of a very difficult situation. "Eeyaw!" shouted the donkey. Eventually somebody heard the donkey, but unfortunately it was a very mean farmer. And the mean farmer saw the dry well, saw the donkey in the bottom, and he never liked the donkey, always stealing the farmer's vegetables and grass. So he decided, so did the farmer, to, as it were, just to finish off the donkey and fill up the well at the same time. He got out a spade and started digging earth up and throwing it into the well to fill up the well with the donkey at the bottom. It was a very, very cruel and nasty thing to do. And always when we do cruel and nasty things, you always find that the bad karma comes back to bite you, as it happened in this story. Because the donkey, as soon as it realized that the farmer was trying to bury it alive, trying to kill it, the donkey shouted even louder, "Eeyaw! Eeyaw! Eeyaw!" Which in donkey language means, "Don't kill me." But then the donkey fell silent, and the farmer thought he hadn't put that much dirt into the hole. He didn't know why the donkey had stopped shouting so soon, but he thought maybe he had a heart attack or maybe he just lay down. But anyway, the donkey was obviously dead. So thought the farmer. He just carried on putting earth into the hole. More and more earth, because he had to finish off burying the donkey and filling up the hole. But what the farmer didn't realize was that donkey had developed insight, had developed some wisdom. Instead of shouting and complaining when things are going wrong, which is what most people do in life, especially at a time like this, even when it's a life and death matter, instead of shouting and complaining, the donkey just stood there. And when the next shovelful of earth was thrown over its head, the donkey just shook it off, stamped it in under its feet, and the donkey was an inch higher. Another shovelful of earth, shaking it off, not complaining, stamped it in under its feet, another inch higher. And this had been going on a long time. And eventually, two donkey ears appeared above the top of the well. But the farmer wasn't paying any attention. The farmer didn't practice mindfulness, awareness of his surroundings, or any insight. He was a very bad man, just wanted to kill the donkey and fill up the well. So a few more shovelfuls of earth. Shake it off. Stamp it in under his feet, and the donkey grew another inch closer to the escape. And soon the donkey was so close to the top of the well, he just jumped over the edge of the well and was free. But before he was free, before he ran away, the donkey decided, out of compassion of course, to bite the farmer on the backside. As I say, I can't resist this, please excuse me. They say because he wanted to remind him of his ass, to look after the donkeys instead of trying to kill them. And also to say that that's bad karma. You must remember never to be cruel to anybody in this world. And the reason that's how the donkey escaped from the well, not by complaining, but by figuring out that whatever happens to us in life, if we're in the bottom of a well and we're being buried alive, that death is happening. It's amazing that when you don't worry, there's always things which you can do. There's ways of coping. There's ways of seeing things in a different way. And, who knows, making something out of your desperate situation. And of course, that's what's happening now in many parts of the world. When people are just focusing on the obvious real dangers and misery and sometimes depression which comes from the situation of this COVID-19 virus. But even though it's a very difficult situation, there's always something which we can do with it. Always something which can happen. Recently, I got an email from the college where I went to as a young student in Cambridge, and they were saying that they had shut down their college as well. And of course, these colleges were so old, it wasn't the first time they'd shut down. And they were telling that in their records, the previous time they'd shut down totally because of pandemics was during the plagues in the 17th century. In 1665 and 1666. That plague just destroyed so many livelihoods, so they had to shut down the college. And at that time, one of the people at Trinity College, but up at Cambridge University, was a gentleman called Sir Isaac Newton. And he had to leave the college and go up to Lincolnshire somewhere, to what we'd call these days socially isolate. And that while he was there, in his notes, he said this was one of the most fruitful intellectual times of his life. Many of his great discoveries would obviously have happened there when he was away by himself, alone. There's so much that we can learn when we're by ourselves. It's not only that, but I have to say that at the same time there was another fellow who was this time at the college where I was at, Emmanuel College, called John Harvard. And of course, that's the John Harvard who founded Harvard University in Massachusetts, USA. And if any of you ever do visit that place in the future, and you look at the famous statue of John Harvard standing there in front of one of the buildings, you will notice just on the pedestal on which he is standing, there is this called the Lion Rampant. It's an emblem, which is the emblem of Emmanuel College in Cambridge, where I studied. But one of the alumni of that college, of Emmanuel College, eventually became the Bishop of Southwark Cathedral, and he gave this lecture about the origin of Harvard University, where it actually came from. And he had all the documents there to prove his research was valid. Because it was in Southwark, south of the River Thames, in London, where John Harvard's family were from. And his father was a very successful businessman. He had pubs, gambling dens apparently, and please excuse me, houses of ill repute, you know, prostitution and stuff. And this was just south of the River Thames. And the reason why he made so much money out of that was because north of the River Thames was controlled by the Puritans, and he was part of the Diocese of Westminster. So, in brief, every Saturday night, you might say, all the people of London went over the bridges, you know, to have their merriment, because north of the River Thames you couldn't even get any alcohol. So because of that, John Harvard's family made a fortune. But maybe because of their, you know, livelihood, there were during the plagues, his whole family living in the Diocese of Southwark, just south of the River Thames, were all killed, they all died in the plague, which meant that John Harvard was the sole inheritor of all of that money. And he left England to go to the United States with all that money, and with that money he founded Harvard University. And please excuse me, on the wages of sin. But anyway, and it was all because of a pandemic at the time. But anyway, that was just an interesting, of course, Harvard University has moved on since those times. But it's amazing what happens, the unexpected things which happen during emergencies. And just what can occur when things go wrong. There's always some opportunities for growth, understanding, compassion. Which is why I always like to call disasters, pandemics, there's a bushfire, there's all these things as opportunities. Opportunities, instead of just staying in the bottom of the well and complaining, to be able to shake it off. Yes, it's still a bit dirty and unpleasant, sometimes very unpleasant. Shake it off, dig it in and grow from it. It's part of the thing which I still remember from my teachings and experience with a great teacher like an Ajahn Chah. When anything was a difficulty for me, Ajahn Chah would always ask me to regard that as my teacher. To not regard Ajahn Chah as my teacher, but some of the difficult aspects of life in the forests. Because these were forests in northeast Thailand, and the food was very rough, and it's all they had, so you had to eat it. There was no choice in the matter. And it was hot, and there was many diseases there. I remember one sort of doctor said it was like a soup of bacteria, and you were really lucky not to catch more of these bacteria. But, you know, I was reasonably healthy, but whenever you did get a sickness, or whenever you did get an irritation, whenever anything happened to you which was unpleasant, and you went to your teacher to try and get some sympathy, he said, no, that is your teacher now, the fever you have. Look at that as your teacher. What is it trying to teach you? When there was just really, really hot weather, and it was very dry, that heat, that discomfort, that is your teacher. When the forest was very noisy because of so many animals, the noise, because you couldn't sleep, your sleeplessness, that was your teacher. And don't run away from the lessons of life. Don't try and cut classes. Stay there, even though it's a bit unpleasant, because you learn so much, you know, from nature. Nature is a teacher in its many forms, and it teaches us so many lessons, like the COVID-19 is teaching us so many, many lessons. And you find that during those disasters, during those pandemics, during the times when many, many people die, many people live as well. And so those people who live, do they learn? Do they grow? Do they understand anything? Or is it just something which we look upon as a trauma for the rest of our lives, instead of growing from it? And how can you say growing from it? Because all of the pain of life, it will come back to us if we don't go into it and understand it. We usually run away from difficulties of life. Whenever there is a fire, we run in the opposite direction. Yes, I don't know why, maybe I'm a crazy monk, but I remember some of the occasions when, instead of running away, I run towards. And the memory which comes up was the time when I first came to Western Australia. I've been here 37 years now. And when I first came over here, I volunteered to actually go and teach in some of the prisons. And one of the prisons I would go and teach in regularly was over in Bunbury Prison. Once a week, I think I would go down there. And the only way to get the transport down there was get on the train. And then I would stay the afternoon in Bunbury, and then in the evening go to the prison to give the meditation talks. And I enjoyed it. But in the afternoon, I remember one afternoon, I was just meditating on the beach in Bunbury. There's no one there at that time, middle of the afternoon, meditating very quietly, usually a couple of hours meditating. And then, I felt this, I didn't feel it, but I could hear this whiz going past my ear. And then another sound past the other ear, and realized that someone was throwing stones at me. And then another stone, and then another stone. And I realized that if I kept sitting there for any longer, soon one of those stones might hit me. And the people throwing it would make bad karma. It's amazing, I wasn't so afraid of hurt or pain. I must be honest with you. So I opened my eyes, and I stood up, turned around. I noticed there was maybe about 8 or 9 boys, maybe 14 or 15, could be a bit younger, maybe 13 or 14, throwing stones in my direction. And one of them just shouted out, "Get off our beach, Rajneeshi!" This was the days of Bhagavan Sri Rajneesh, when people thought he was going to come to Perth to open up a center, and he sent one of his senior disciples to talk to the media, and she was very, very unpleasant, apparently. And so they thought that I was a Rajneeshi just because I had a bald head and a brown robe, and started throwing stones at me. So what do you do in difficult situations like that? That's your teacher. How do you respond? So, because of my training, Rajanchara, you shrug it off, turn around and walk towards those young boys. And it was wonderful because That was the last thing they expected, for me to turn around and walk towards them. They would expect me just to run away. But anyway, I walked towards them. And about, you know, I say about 8 or 9 of them. And they all ran away. They were the ones who ran away. I didn't have to throw any stones. I just throwed my courage and fearlessness at them, just walking slowly towards them. One of them stayed, the rest ran away. And I asked him, why are you throwing those stones? And when they explained to me, he said, look, I'm not a Rajneeshi. I'm a Buddhist monk, and even if I were a Rajneeshi, it's not the right thing to throw stones at people sitting on the beach. And then we had a nice conversation about Buddhism and meditation, and the other kids came up and joined in the conversation, and we parted as friends. And they realized their mistake. So that was my teacher for that day, a stone coming past my ear and another stone. Instead of just rejecting it, just go towards it. And I found that often in any sicknesses which I've had, and some of those sicknesses you don't go to see the doctors, you go to see the sickness instead. You go right inside, instead of running away. Instead of thinking, oh, give me something to get over the pain. No, you go into the pain. Instead of, I'll get rid of this ache. No, you go into the ache. Instead of running away, you run into things. When you do that, you learn so much about the body and the way it reacts to sicknesses and pains. You know, this is only my personal experience, obviously, but I can't see why my body is any different than anybody else's body. When you actually go into these feelings, you can learn how to understand them and relax them, and things get loose. And just energies start to come into your body, and you start to heal up. It's a wonderful little experience, just not being afraid of aches and pains in the body. And even a fever. If there is a fever, it's the body's way of dealing with the bacteria or the virus within you. As long as that fever doesn't get too high, it's the body's way of coping. And so sometimes, I remember reading in a book a long time ago, because we had no access to doctors in those early years in northeast Thailand. There's no telephones or anything like that, and the doctor was too far away. So I remember this little book we had, Where There Is No Doctor, it was titled, written by a doctor who had gone to Central America to volunteer in very remote areas and to help all sorts of people. And it gave lots of wonderful information about how to care instead of curing. And that became one of those great insights a long time later, to care for diseases instead of curing them. Sometimes the curing them is just... The curing them sometimes makes them worse. Disease is part of life. As I've often said here, that, you know, how many people have never been sick in their lives? And of course, it's very, very rare to find anyone who's never been sick. Actually, I've never met anyone in my whole life who's never been sick. Sickness is natural. It's part of nature. Fevers are nature. Pandemics are nature. People dying is nature. We don't like it, but we have to expect it. We have to open the door of our heart and bring these things in, to go inside of them and let them come inside you. I don't mean to go and deliberately get sick, but I mean to understand the whole situation of what's happening, and to learn from it, to grow from it. I know that there's many people, I get lots of emails still, even though you're socially disengaged. It's amazing, when you're socially disengaged, I think somebody said that in UK they're calling it physically disengaged, because socially you're getting more emails than ever. So the last couple of weeks it's almost like socially more engaged. I'm contacting more people, talking more, writing more, contacting people more. And I think it is just to share, you know, your understanding and knowledge in a difficult time. It's not a time when money really helps. It's not a time just when doing much helps, except the spiritual path of accepting by going into it and understanding just people's response to these things. And sometimes even the response which we have, you know, and it's wonderful just to see how many medical personnel are literally sacrificing their lives to help. It's a very difficult situation. Just got one email from a person who's been on one of my retreats, who's a doctor in Spain, just frontline worker, and saying that it's just so difficult when you have to make decisions. Who gets the ventilator and who gets the palliative care? In other words, one person's going to die, the other person's going to survive, because it's not enough for everybody. You may feel that that's a difficult decision, but these are people actually making those decisions. And sometimes I understand that their anxiety creates so much tiredness, so much exhaustion, that they cannot do their duties properly. But if they have a means, a way of understanding what they're doing, to learning, to growing. And of course, one of the things is we're such a blaming generation of human beings. Always blaming, it's this person's fault, that person's fault, the government's fault, something's fault. And a lot of time that blame also comes on oneself. It's my fault, I should have done it better. All of your life, my understanding of human beings, and I've already mentioned going to teach in places like prisons, you're not supposed to, remember the word supposed, you're not supposed to meet the best people in prisons, but there's some amazing human beings in those jails. And even to some of the worst of them, worst, I'm not sure if that's the best word, that some of the beauty and goodness and wisdom in them is amazing. It sometimes shocks me. So all the human beings in the world, always, this is my experience, you may argue with me, always trying to do the best, whatever they feel to be the best. Sometimes they get it terribly wrong. But underneath them, they're trying to make a better world deep inside. And if we can try and harness that, the inherent goodness in the human being, the inherent just wanting just to have peace and happiness and joy in this world, realizing that sometimes we can't have it, and sometimes we have to learn how to let go. And not always live in a myth of beliefs that, oh, you just can join this religion and you'll be totally safe, or someone will pray for you and that will fix everything. Even some Buddhists, some of the beliefs which I've read just astound me. Instead of trying to get rid of these problems, to understand them instead, to understand them, and to realize there's nothing wrong with people dying and other people living. It's not somebody's fault. Oh, a long time ago, I was impressed by the simple wisdom of people who live much closer to nature than people, you know, who live in great cities. And this was that story of an old monk who told me that when he was living in this forest by himself, in a simple hut. I mean, the huts were really simple in those days. You didn't have any council regulations to meet. So if it worked, you lived in it. If it got damaged, you fixed it by yourself. So it was one of these huts. I think it was leaves on the for the roof. It had these huge leaves in the jungles. And so you can put a few of those leaves on with some twigs, not twigs, more like branches, or even you can find some bamboo, that was some of the best, and that would actually keep the roof dry, or keep underneath the roof dry. It was a nice little awning, and you could build such a simple hut out of that with what was laying in the forest, not even needing any nails. So he was living in one of these very simple huts in the forest. It was just nice and peaceful. And he said that one evening there was a very heavy storm, and he could not go to sleep all night because of fear of dying. And because all these trees came crashing down. As you hear, even in Bodhinyana Monastery in Serpentine, every now and again one of the big trees smashed to the ground. But in the morning, when he got up, he saw the damage. If one of those trees had even nicked his hut, he would have gone straight through and probably killed him, or even worse. If he lived in those jungles in those days, even worse than being killed was being injured. It just meant the death process would last much longer. There was no way of escape. So anyway, this old monk said that in the morning he looked at all of the damage in the forest. But what took his attention, what really captured his mind, was not the trees, not the branches, not the twigs, but the leaves on the forest floor. So that was what really stunned him, because he saw, living in nature, just how life works. Most of the leaves on the forest floor were the old brown leaves, lived their life, and now they were dead on the forest floor. But amongst all those brown leaves was many yellow leaves. Amongst the yellow leaves was a few green leaves, and there was these young green leaves. You know them when you see them. They're just so bright green, they're just freshly sprung the night before, probably. They'd also been torn off and lay dead on the floor. Why? Why, young people? No, what they call these days, no underlying health problems. They get coronavirus and they die. And old people, just saw in that news, the oldest person in the world right now is 112. He lives in England somewhere. He's probably fine. Why is it? The old monk looked up in the trees and he told me, he's like laughing. When you understand the truth of life and death, of nature, it's sort of amusing in a sense, because he knew what to expect when he looked up at the trees. Most of the leaves which were left there were the green leaves. But still, even though many, many old brown leaves and green leaves and yellow leaves were lying dead on the floor, there were still a few old brown leaves, still on the twigs, still alive, curled up, but just still hanging on there, even though the storm had ripped up so many leaves younger than them and put them on the floor dead. He understood the nature of life and death. Storms come, pandemics, tsunamis, bushfires, or just other diseases of life. Yes, the old ones are more susceptible, but the young ones die as well. And it's nothing which has gone wrong. There's no one to blame. We all try our best. And sometimes we try more than our best and wear ourselves out and become victims ourselves. So, in order to be of service to this world, in order to really care, have compassion, that old saying that a bird needs two wings, one wing is compassion, the other one is wisdom, to know how to care, know how to deal with the difficulties and problems of life. Know about how your body works, what you can do, what you can't do. It's one of the reasons why I kept on saying that caring is more important than curing. That's where the power lies, in caring. Even if a person dies, if you die, you died well, because you lived well. The length of your life, because Buddhists understand reincarnation, rebirth, the length of your life is not so important as the quality of your life. If you care rather than try and cure, you're focusing on quality, not results. Which means that you live a much more beautiful, peaceful, happy life. And it also means that you understand it's not just about them, that you're involved. You're part of this journey. You can't just forget about yourself, nor can you just focus on yourself. That wonderful little simile when people get married. It's not about you, it's not about your partner, it's always about us. This world is all about us. Many people will die because of the pandemic. Many people will survive, the majority will survive. What I really hope is those who do survive will learn, will grow, will become wiser and compassionate about just what they can do, what they can't do. Life is out of control. We controlled it a little bit. But the one thing which is always there is change. Change never rests. Change, things altering, is something which you can rely upon. It's always been there for me. Always know that things aren't going to be the same today as they were yesterday. And I'm willing to accept that and grow with it and change with it. Still, Ajahn Brahmani was reminding me about the big bushfire we had in Bodhinyana Monastery so many years ago, 1991, I think it was. And in there, the trees were exploding, literally. Because in the hot weather, and it was the second hottest day ever recorded in Western Australia, at the time it was the hottest day. Another day, 2 weeks later, exceeded that. It was about 46 point something over in Perth, and in Serpentine, where I was at the time. When the bushfire came, trees exploded because at that temperature all the eucalyptus oil in the leaves evaporates and forms this blue shroud around the trees. Mixing with the oxygen in the air, the eucalyptus oil evaporated just with oxygen, just a spark, and bang! And it was awesome to see. And at the time I thought that was the end of Bodhinyana Monastery. But now look at it. Bodhinyana Monastery has grown so much since then. Many of the huts which were there at the time are still there. Many of the trees still bear the burn marks. Survived, grown, understood, developed. It was a time to let go. When we understand that time to let go, it's a time of wisdom and kindness. We let go to rest, so the following morning we can start work again. And each of these experiences of our life, opportunities where we do really learn. You don't learn Buddhism by reading books or by, please excuse me, by listening to talks from a monk like me, as much as you learn the Dhamma from the experiences of your life. They may not be pleasant experiences, but you learn so much from them. They may not be what you expect, but they are teachings nevertheless. Like nature, always helping us, teaching us, giving us instructions. And the quicker we learn, the more peaceful and free we will feel. So hopefully this little talk, which again as usual is never scripted, is never planned, just thoughts, feelings, discussions which I've had recently, all comes up, and I hope it's useful for you. So now I'm going to pause and to open up for the questions. And the questions coming from not the room here, the room is empty except for a couple of people doing the audiovisual work. So I have some questions over here. And of course I'll be repeating this schedule the next Friday, the Friday afterwards, and also tomorrow afternoon, Saturday afternoon, we always have a 3 p.m. meditation to about 4:15. Usually does the little talk about meditation and then the meditation itself for 40, 45 minutes, followed by the opportunity to ask questions. And so please tomorrow, because again, we can't have any people in the hall except the workers. So it means that please, you can put your questions down online and I'll try and answer them tomorrow. And that will be up till about 4:15, 4:30. And this will also occur the week afterwards and the week after that. So it's something you can rely upon, I hope. So first of all, from Germany, during the meditation. During meditation, there are songs popping up in my mind all the time, and they're not even my favorite ones. How can I deal with this one? So you hear songs coming up in the mind. You can almost actually ask yourself, well, why do those songs come up? They're not your favorite ones, but why do those ones? There must be some trigger somewhere. Either were the songs which remind you of unpleasant times or pleasant times or whatever. But my own story about that, I've been a monk meditating for I think over 50 years now. So I got lots and lots of stories. But I do remember living in a forest monastery in the northeast of Thailand so long ago, you didn't hear any music. You know, for years I hadn't heard any music. And then going down to Bangkok, I'm not exaggerating, just, you know, you didn't hear these things in the forest. And so many, many years afterwards, maybe 5 or 6 years, I had to go down to Bangkok to do visas. And I remember just being in a little room and somebody walked past my room with one of these radios, and they were playing some pop music. And I made a mistake of really listening to it. And it was very delightful to listen to sort of some song, which was probably in the hit parade somewhere. But the point is, as soon as I started listening to it and enjoying it, it got stuck in my head. And I couldn't sort of get it out. And I kept on meditating, repeating the music to myself. Over and over and over and over and over again. It's the songs pop up and get stuck. So a long time, in a couple of days being concerned with this, is the solution I found, which worked for me anyway, was actually instead of trying to stop the sound, which didn't work and made it come up more and more and more, I always discover when you fight something, it usually makes it worse. You try to get rid of it, it stays much longer. So instead of trying to get rid of it, I decided to really get into it. And especially with the ending, the finale, the last few seconds, instead of whatever it was and then carrying on again, I really gave it everything, emphasis. When I emphasize the endings, then the beginnings never occurred. It's an interesting psychology. For many people, we actually celebrate the beginnings of things. Birthdays. We don't celebrate death days. The building of a new hall. Yay! We have a big opening ceremony. We never have any ceremonies when it gets falling down and needs a repairman to work extra time helping it out. We don't celebrate that. We always celebrate when things begin. And I thought, no, I'm going to celebrate when the things end by really adding extra emphasis to the endings of things. And that was just with little songs which were grabbing my mind. When I emphasized the ending became more important than the beginning, which meant the beginning never came up again. Interesting little change of perception. And it always reminded me of Ajahn Chah saying that he preferred ending of things rather than beginning of things. Ending of things means the day is ended, the work is finished. Now you can relax. What happens when people relax? Okay, this is finished. Now what should we begin? Let's do something else. And no, just remember the endings are more beautiful than the beginnings. Because they lead to peace, tranquility, and rest. Human beings are also very tired. So we need to celebrate more endings than beginnings. The next question, what is the best way for someone to get back into spiritual life? It's been a long time since I've meditated, maybe an entire year. Actually, that's not that long, an entire year, since you meditated. But the very fact you've listened to the talk here this evening, the very fact you've asked that question is the greatest step. The greatest step is to notice what it's like when something important is being ignored. Just to notice that, as Ajahn Chah would always remind me, that meditation is food for the heart. And if you don't eat, you get very, very hungry, very weak. You don't have the resources to deal with the difficult situations of life. So when you look at meditation, or the spiritual life, is the food for the heart, for the mind, for the inside world, not the outside world. You'll find that that is just so crucial. Yes, you eat well, you exercise, you sleep well, but you also meditate well, kind, generous, virtuous. Those are also important. That's your spiritual health. And when you put a lot of focus on that as well as the external, you're a balanced individual. So the best way to get back into a spiritual life is keep tuning into this BSWA. That will help. Get some of your own resources more local. Sit there and just, by meditating, being able to listen to what's being said and then closing your eyes and following. That's a wonderful way. If ever you were learning how to drive a car, you'd always have the driving instructor sitting next to you until you could drive by yourself. So having these guided meditations, which are, as my predecessor who used to teach here, Ajahn Jaco, used to say, the cheapest and the best from the BSWA. Don't have to pay anything for them, but doesn't mean they're low quality, they're very high quality meditation teachings. And you can listen to them, you can feel them, grow with them, and then it's just like having a monk sitting next to you in the car when you're learning how to drive. It's like having the teacher there whenever you need to have some spiritual sustenance. So that's a good way of doing it, guided meditations. And lastly, my friend is too anxious and is in denial of the pandemic. She asked me to agree with this view and I say no, and she becomes disappointed or depressed. How can I continue talking to her without agreeing with her delusional view? It's anxious. Sometimes they're anxious and denying. What is he actually afraid of? Sometimes if that was me, I would actually maybe tell her, say, oh well, darling, you may be right. Don't say she is right, but she may be right. Are you really always so sure? Ah, can I tell that story because the AV person, have you got time to come? Yes, we've got time. The story, it's one of my favorite stories. I'm sure the person who asked this question knows this. The story of the two people who were married walking through the forest when they heard a sound, quack, quack. And straight away that, oh, I have to change this around. Straight away that she said, oh, darling, can you hear that? That's a duck. And he said, no, no, it's not a duck, it's a chicken. She said, no, it's a duck. He said, it's a chicken. It went quack, quack again. There you go, it's a chicken, he said. No, it's a duck. No, it's a chicken. No, it's a duck. No, it's a chicken. They're always having a fight. And in this story, the wife was the smart one. She was the one who was saying, it was a duck. He said, it's a chicken. And it went quack, quack. So she looked at him and said, oh, darling, you know, I think you may be right. That is a chicken. He went quack, quack again. And then they held hands and had a wonderful walk. Thank you, darling. What's more important, being right or being in harmony, being in love? Sometimes it doesn't really matter if it's a chicken or a duck. But being in harmony, not fighting, is more important. And anyway, because I've been telling that story, I think Ajahn Chah told that story to me, you know, so many years ago, or 40 years ago now. And since that time, I've been repeating it a lot. And of course, people send me all these emails, and there was a real chicken. It was a poor little chicken when it was born, it was orphaned. So it was adopted by a mother duck. This is true. I've got the paper somewhere. It was adopted by a family of ducks. And this little chicken goes quack, quack. It's a chicken. That's its species. That's what it is. But it goes quack, quack. So there is, and I've got evidence, there is one chicken in this world, at least, who goes quack, quack. So just because it goes quack, quack does not mean it's a duck. So, but anyway, she's in denial of the pandemic. So I say, oh, you may be right, darling, but, you know, just because I'm anxious about you. I'm anxious. I don't want you to die or to get sick. So would you mind, please, darling? You may be right. But, you know, just being careful. So sometimes you have to, when you're talking with a person, sometimes to connect with them first. And as you connect with them first, and they realize you are hearing them, that you are respecting their view, and little by little, they respect your view. And together you can walk more closely on a path of truth, but harmony first of all. That's one amazing way when I remember reading an article about people with schizophrenia, and one of the most wonderful ways of dealing with that is not telling the person when they see heads, human heads alive rolling on the floor. This was just what I read. You don't say, you're nuts, that can't be happening. You actually validate their experience. Doesn't matter how unreal it sounds to you, how impossible it sounds. Say, oh yeah, well that's interesting, how many heads are they? And you find out when they don't feel so challenged, so rejected, so, respecting is the best word there, then they tend to relax more, become more amenable to seeing that that may be a bit weird, that the experiences of delusions become less strong when they give some validation to them first of all. So, people who are in denial of the pandemic just say, well, you may be right. But then little by little they trust you, and little by little they will come around to the truth. Anyway, how can you continue talking to her without agreeing with her delusional view? don't even call it a delusional view. There's maybe a different way of looking at life. And then little by little, you bring people around. Hope that makes sense. So anyway, is there any more questions? Okay. So I hope that worked for you this evening. For those people listening online, and I wish you all happiness and well-being.